Well, good morning and hello. It's Cory Doctorow here, and you're listening to my podcast. This podcast is brought to you by Buckley's Mixture, not in the sense that they've sponsored it in any way, but in that this wonderful Canadian cough syrup, Buckley's Mixture, which tastes like death, is the only reason that I'm able to actually utter intelligible sentences today, because I have a rotten cold. And this is a completely unpaid endorsement, but I tell you what, without this stuff, I would not be half the man I am today. This is kind of what keeps me going through the year, as colds and germs creep down my esophagus and my trachea and infest me. Especially now that I've got a little baby who goes to the creche, and which is a nursery school for those of you who aren't British, and develops all kinds of wonderful and exotic illnesses to pass on to her parents. It used to be that I would only get colds because I would go to the UN on behalf of Electronic Frontier Foundation, which was kind of, I used to call it the UN of germs because, several times a year, people from all over the world would bring their microbes into one room and exchange them. And I thought I was past that when I retired from doing that work, but here I am back again, sick as a dog, thanks to the baby, who is otherwise a treat and a delight, and is getting her 1 year molars and is about to have her 1 year birthday. So, what's new? Good work on For the Win. That's my next novel, my novel length adaptation of Anda's Game. I've been working on it, well, I think since the last time I spoke to you, more or less. I'm doing 1,000 words a day, every day, no problem. Cooking along, tickety-boo, as they say here in the United Kingdom, and rocketing forward, and soon will be complete, I hope. Probably another 2.5 months for a full draft, at this rate, anyway. And of course, that's not to say that there aren't lots of distractions coming up that might keep me from keeping up this pace. The first one being Confusion. This is the awesome convention in Michigan, just outside of Detroit, that I'm off to on Thursday. I'm going to land in Toronto and then borrow my parents' car and drive to Detroit because Detroit's economy is such that British Airways doesn't fly there anymore. They've discontinued their direct flights, which is like unbelievably interesting to think of, that this once great city has lost its direct air service. And there are very few airlines that actually fly direct from London to Detroit. It's not even much of a hub anymore. And then later on, I'm going to be heading over to New York for the Tools of Change conference. That's February 9th, 10th, and 11th. And that's the O'Reilly Future Publishing event. I'm thinking about what I'm going to talk about, and just I this morning, I think I kind of got it together, which is it's going to be why publishers are in danger of repeating the mistake that the record labels made when they let Apple iTunes DRM become the dominant platform for distributing music and so lost control of their retail destiny, and how if you allow Amazon or Sony DRM to become dominant in book publishing, or Audible's DRM to become dominant in audiobook publishing, they may face the same fate. My understanding is that O'Reilly will be putting audio online, so I'll drop that in the feed when the time comes. So that's all the news that's fit to print. I'm not sure how long my voice will hold out for today, so I'm going to just get reading. As those of you who've been listening in will know, this is the third reading from Someone Comes to Town, Someone Leaves Town, my 2005 novel. Looking at the little progress bar here on the screen that I've been reading from, incidentally, I'm just reading from the HTML version of the book that's on my site at craphound.com/someone. And looking at that little slide bar, it looks like I'm kind of maybe 10%, 15% through. So that leaves me with a couple more months, anyways, of reading aloud from this before we get all the way through. And like I said earlier, I haven't read this book since I wrote it, pretty much. So I'm rediscovering it at the same time as some of you are discovering it for the first time. It's really exciting. So here's part three. The sun set at 9 p.m. in a long summertime blaze. Alan sat down on the twig chair on his front porch, pulled up the matching twig table, and set down a wine glass and a bottle of Niagara Chardonnay he'd brought up from the cellar. He poured out a glass and held it up to the light, admiring the new blister he'd gotten on his pinky finger while hauling 2x4s and gyprock from his truck to his neighbor's front room. Kids rode by on bikes, and punks rode by on skateboards. Couples wandered through the park across the street, their murmurous conversations clear on the whispering breeze that rattled the leaves. He hadn't gotten any writing done, but that was all right. He had plenty of time, and once the sound wall was in, he'd be able to get a good night's sleep and really focus down on the story. A Chinese girl and a white boy walked down the sidewalk, talking intensely. They were all of 6, and the boy had a Russian accent. The market's diversity always excited Alan. The boy looked a little like Alan's brother Doug, Dan, David, Dearborn, had looked when he was that age. Doug was the one he'd helped murder. All the brothers had helped with the murder, even Charlie, Clem, Carlos, Corey, the island, who'd opened a great fissure down his main fault line and closed it up over Doug's corpse, ensuring that their parents would be none the wiser. Doug was a stubborn son of a bitch, though, and his corpse had tunneled up over the next 6 years, built a raft from the bamboo and vines that grew in proliferation on Carlos's west coast. He'd sailed the raft through the treacherous seas for a year and a day, beached it on their father's gentle slope, and presented himself to their mother. By that time, the corpse had decayed and frayed and worn away, so that he was little more than a torso and stumps, his tongue withered and stiff, but he pled his case to their mother, and she was so upset that her load overbalanced and they had to restart her. Their father was so angry that he quaked and caved in Billy, Bob, Brad, Benny's room, crushing all his tools and all his trophies. But a lot of time had gone by, and the brothers weren't kids anymore. Alan was 19, ready to move to Toronto and start scouting for real estate. Only Doug still looked like a little boy, albeit a stumpy and desiccated one. He hollered and stamped until his finger bones rattled on the wall and his tongue flew across the room and cracked on the wall. He hollered and stamped until his finger bones rattled on the floor and his tongue flew across the room and cracked on the wall. When his anger was spent, he crawled atop their mother and let her rock him into a long, long slumber. Alan had left his father and his family the next morning, carrying a rucksack heavy with gold from under the mountain, and walked down to the town, taking the same trail he'd walked every school day since he was 5. He waved to the people that drove past him on the highway as he waited at the bus stop. He was the first son to leave home under his own power, and he'd been full of butterflies, but he had a half dozen good books that he'd checked out of the Kappa's Casing branch library to keep him occupied on the 14-hour journey. And before he knew it, the bus was pulling off the Gardiner Expressway by the Sky Dome into the midnight streets of Toronto, where the buildings stretched up to the sky, where the blinking lights of the Yonge Street sleaze strip receded into the distance like a landing strip for a horny UFO. His liquid cash was tight, so he spent that night in the Rex Hotel, in the worst room in the house, right over the cymbal tree that the jazz drummer below hammered on until nearly 2 a.m. The bed was small and hard and smelled of bleach and must. The watch basin gurgled mysteriously and spat out moist sewage odors, and he'd read all his books. So he sat in the window and watched the drunks and the hipsters stagger down Queen Street and inhaled the smoky air, and before he knew it, he'd nodded off in the chair with his heavy coat around him like a blanket. The Chinese girl abruptly thumped her fist into the Russian boy's ear. He clutched his head and howled, tears streaming down his face, while the Chinese girl ran off. Alan shook his head, got up off his chair, and went inside for a cold washcloth and an ice pack, and came back out. The Russian boy's face was screwed up and blotchy and streaked with tears, and it made him look even more like Doug, who'd always been a crybaby. Alan couldn't understand him, but he took a guess and knelt at his side and wiped the boy's face, then put the ice pack in his little hand and pressed it to the side of his little head. "Come on," he said, taking the boy's other hand. "Where do your parents live? I'll take you home." Alan met Krishna the next morning at 10 a.m. as Alan was running a table saw on the neighbor's front lawn, sawing studs up to fit the second wall. Krishna came out of the house in a dirty dressing gown, his short hair matted with gel from the night before. He was tall and fit and muscular, his brown calves flashing through the vent of his house coat. He was smoking a hand-rolled cigarette and clutching a can of Coke. Alan shut down the saw and shifted his goggles up to his forehead. "Good morning," he said. "I'd stay on the porch if I were you, or maybe put on some shoes. There are a lot of nails and splinters around." Krishna, about to step off the porch, stepped back. "You must be Alvin," he said. "Yup," Alan said, going up the stairs, sticking out his hand. "And you must be Krishna. You're pretty good with a guitar, you know that?" Krishna shook briefly, then snatched his hand back and rubbed it as stubble. "I know. You're pretty fucking loud with a table saw." Alan looked sheepish. "Sorry about that. I wanted to get the heavy work done before it got too hot. Hope I'm not disturbing you too much. Today's the only sawing day. I'll be hammering for the next day or two, then it's all wet work. The loudest tool I'll be using is sandpaper. Won't take more than 4 days tops anyway, and we'll be in good shape. Krishna gave him a long, considering look. What are you, anyway? I'm a writer, for now. Used to have a few shops. Krishna blew a plume of smoke off into the distance. That's not what I mean. What are you, Adam, Alan, Andrew? I've met people like you before. There's something not right about you. Alan didn't know what to say to that. This was bound to come up someday. Where are you from? Up north, near Kappa's Casing, he said. A little town. I don't believe you, Krishna said. Are you an alien? A fairy? What? Alan shook his head. Just about what I seem, I'm afraid. Just a guy. Just about, huh? He said. Just about. There's a lot of wiggle room in just about, Arthur. It's a free country, but just the same, I don't think I like you very much. Far as I'm concerned, you could get lost and never come back. Sorry you feel that way, Krishna. I hope I'll grow on you as time goes by. I hope that you won't have the chance to, Krishna said, flicking the dog end of his cigarette toward the sidewalk. Alice didn't like or understand Krishna, but that was okay. He understood the others just fine, more or less. Natalie had taken to helping him out after her classes, mudding and taping the drywall, then sanding it down, priming it, and painting it. Her brother Link came home from work sweaty and grimy with road dust, but he always grabbed a beer for Natalie and Alan after his shower, then they'd sit on the porch and kibitz. Mimi was less hospitable. She sulked in her room while Alan worked on the sound wall, coming downstairs only to fetch her breakfast and coldly ignoring him then, despite his cheerful greetings. Alan had to force himself not to stare after her as she walked into the kitchen, carrying yesterday's dishes down from her room, then out again with a sandwich on a fresh plate. Her curly hair bounced as she stomped back and forth, her soft round buttocks flexing under her long johns. On the night that Alan and Natalie put the first coat of paint on the wall, Mimi came down in a little baby doll dress, thigh-high striped tights, and chunky shoes, her face painted with swaths of glitter. "You look wonderful, baby," Natalie told her as she emerged on the porch. "Going out?" "Going to the club," she said. "DJ, none of your fucking business is spinning, and Krishna's going to get me in for free." "Dance music," Link said, disgustedly. Then to Alan, "You know that stuff? It's not playing music. It's playing records. Snore." "Sounds interesting," Alan said. "Do you have any of it that I could listen to? A CD or some MP3s?" "Oh, that's not how you listen to this stuff," Natalie said. "You have to go to a club and dance." "Really?" Alan said. "Do I have to take ecstasy, or is that optional?" "It's mandatory," Mimi said, after the first words she'd spoken to him all week. "Great fistfuls of E, and then you have to consume 2 pounds of candy necklaces at an after-hour orgy." "Not really," Natalie said, sotto voce, "but you do have to dance. You should go along with, Mimi to the club. DJ, none of your fucking business is amazing." "I don't think Mimi wants company," Alan said. "What makes you say that?" Mimi said, making a dare of it with hip-shot body language. "Get changed and we'll go together. You have to pay to get in, though." Natalie and Link exchanged a raised eyebrow, but Alan was already headed for his place, fumbling for his keys. He bounded up the stairs, swiped a washcloth over his face, threw on a pair of old cargo pants and a faded steel pole bathtub t-shirt that he'd bought from a head shop one day because he liked the words incongruity, though he'd never heard the band, added a faded jean jacket and a pair of high-tech sneakers, grabbed his phone, and bounded back down the stairs. He was convinced that Mimi would be long gone by the time he got back out front, but she was still there, the stripes in her stockings glowing in the slanting light. "Retro chic," she said, and laughed nastily. Natalie gave him a thumbs up and a smile that Alan uncharitably took for a simper, and then felt guilty about it immediately afterward. He returned the thumbs up, and then took off after Mimi, who was already started down Augusta, headed for Queen Street. "What's the cover charge?" he said, once he'd caught up. $20, she said. "It's an all-ages show, so they won't be selling a lot of booze, so there's a high cover." "How's the play coming?" "Fuck off about the play, okay?" she said, and spat on the sidewalk. "All right, then," he said. "I'm going to start writing my story tomorrow," he said.
"Your story, huh?"
"Yep."
"What's that for?"
"What do you mean?" he asked playfully.
"Why are you writing a story?"
"Well, I have to. I've completely redone the house, built that sound wall. It'd be a shame not to write the story now."
"You're writing a story about your house?"
"No, in my house. I haven't decided what the story's about yet. That'll be job one tomorrow."
"You did all that just to have a place to write? Man, I thought I was into procrastination."
He chuckled self-deprecatingly. "I guess you could look at it that way. I just wanted to have a nice creative environment to work in.
The story's important to me is all. What are you going to do with it once you're done? There aren't a whole lot of places that publish short stories these days, you know. Oh, I know it. I'd write a novel if I had the patience, but this isn't for publication yet. It's going into a drawer to be published after I die.
What?
Like Emily Dickinson, wrote thousands of poems, stuck them in a drawer, dropped dead. Someone else published them and she made it into the canon. I'm going to do the same.
That's nuts. Are you dying?
Nope, but I don't want to put this off until I am. Could get hit by a bus, you know. You're a goddamn psycho. Krishna was right. What does Krishna have against me?
I think we both know what that's about, she said.
No, really, what did I ever do to him? They were on Queen Street now, walking east in the early evening crowd, surrounded by summertime hipsters and wafting appetizing smells from the bistros and Jamaican roti shops. She stopped abruptly and grabbed his shoulders and gave him a hard shake.
You're full of shit, Ad Man. I know it and you know it.
I really don't know what you're talking about, honestly.
Fine, let's do this.
She clamped her hand on his forearm and dragged him down a side street and turned down an alley. She stepped into a doorway and started unbuttoning her Alice Blue baby doll dress. Alan looked away embarrassed, glad of the dark, hiding his blush. Once the dress was unbuttoned to the waist, she reached around behind her and unhooked her white underwire bra, which sagged forward under the weight of her heavy breasts. She turned around, treating him to a glimpse of the full curve of her breast under her arm, and shrugged the dress down around her waist. She had two stubby, leathery wings growing out of the middle of her back, just above the shoulder blades. They sat flush against her back, and as Alan watched, they unfolded and flexed, flapped a few times, and settled back into their position, nested among the soft roll of flesh that descended from her neck. Involuntarily, he peered forward, examining the wings, which were covered in fine, downy brown hairs, and their bases roped with muscle and surrounded by a mess of ugly scars.
"You sewed these on?" Alan said, aghast.
She turned around, her eyes bright with tears. Her breast swung free of her unhooked bra.
"No, you fucking idiot. I saw them off. 4 times a year. They just grow back. If I don't cut them, they grow down to my ankles."
Mimi was curiously and incomprehensibly affectionate after she had buttoned up her dress and resumed walking toward the strip of clubs along Richmond Street. She put her hand on his forearm and murmured funny commentary about the outlandishly attired club kids in their plastic cowboy hats, Sailor Moon outfits, and plastic tuxedos. She plucked a cigarette from his lips, dragged on it, and put it back into his mouth, still damp with her saliva, an act that sent a shiver down Alan's neck and made the hair on the backs of his hands stand up. She seemed to think that the wings were self-explanatory and needed no further discussion, and Alan was content to let them stay in his mind's eye, bat-shaped, powerful, restless, surrounded by their gridwork of angry scars. Once they got to the club, Shasta Disaster, a renovated brick bank with robotic halogen spots that swept the sidewalk out front with a throbbing penis logo mark, she let go of his arm and her body stiffened. She said something in the doorman's ear, and he let her pass. When Alan tried to follow her, the bouncer stopped him with a meaty hand on his chest.
"Can I help you, sir?" he said flatly. He was basically a block of fat and muscle with a head on top, arms as thick as Alan's thighs barely contained, and a silver button-down short-sleeved shirt that bound at his armpits.
"Do I pay the cover to you?" Alan asked, reaching for his wallet.
"No, you don't get to pay a cover. You're not coming in."
"But I'm with her," Alan said, gesturing in the direction Mimi had gone. "I'm Krishna's and her neighbor."
"She didn't mention it," the bouncer said. He was smirking now.
"Look," Alan said, "I haven't been to a club in 20 years. Do you guys still take bribes?"
The bouncer rolled his eyes.
"Some might. I don't.
Why don't you head home, sir?"
"That's it, huh?" Alan said. "Nothing I can say or do?"
"Don't be a smart guy," the bouncer said.
"Good night, then," Alan said, and turned on his heel. He walked back up to Queen Street, which was ablaze with TV lights from the open studio out front of the Chum City building. Hordes of teenagers in tiny outrageous outfits milled back and forth from the coffee shop to the studio window, where some band he'd never heard of was performing, generally ambling southwards towards the clubs. Alan bought himself with a 16-syllable Latinate trade name, Mocha Latte Americana Frappespressicino, he liked to call them, at the second cup, and hailed a taxi. He felt only the shortest moment of anger at Mimi, but it quickly cooled and then warmed again, replaced by bemusement. Decrypting the mystical deeds of young people had been his hobby and avocation since he'd hired his first cranky but bright 16-year-old. Mimi had played him, he knew that, deliberately set him up to be humiliated.
but she'd also wanted a moment alone with him, an opportunity to confront him with her wings, wings that were taking on an air of the erotic now in his imagination, much to his chagrin. He imagined that they were soft and pliable as lips, but with spongy cartilage beneath that gave way like livid nipple flesh. The hair must be silky soft, slippery as a pubic thatch, oiled with sweat and juices. Dear, oh dear, he was really getting himself worked up into a lather, imagining the wings drooping to the ground, unfolding powerfully in his living room, encircling him, enveloping him as his lips enveloped the tendon on her neck, as her vagina enveloped him. Whew! The taxi drove right past his place, and that gave Alan a much-needed distraction. Directing the cabbie through the maze of Kensington Market's one-way streets back around to his front door. He tipped the cabbie a couple of bucks over his customary 10% and bummed a cigarette off him, realizing that Mimi had asked him for a butt but had never returned the pack. He puffed and shook his head and stared up the street at the distant lights of College Street, then turned back to his porch. "Hello, Albert," two voices said in unison, speaking from the shadows on his porch. "Jesus," he said, and hit the remote on his key ring that switched on the porch light. It was his brother Edward, the eldest of the nesting dolls, the bark of their trinity, coarse and tough and hollow. He was even fatter than he'd been as a little boy, fat enough that his arms and legs appeared vestigial and unjointed. He struggled panting to his tiny feet, feet like undersized exclamation points beneath the tapered O of his body. His face, though doughy, had not gone to an undefined softness. Rather, every feature had acquired its own rolls of fat, rolls that warred with one another to define his appearance, nose and cheekbones and brow and lips all grotesque and inflated and blubbery. "Eugene," Alan said, "it's been a long time." Edward cocked his head. "It has indeed, big brother. I've got bad news." "What?" Alan leaned to his left, the top half of his body tipping over completely, splitting at his narrow leather belt so that his trunk, neck, and head hung upside down beside his short, cylindrical legs and tiny feet. Inside of him was Frederick, the perennial middle child. Frederick planted his palms on the dry, smooth edges of his older brother's waist and levered himself up, stepping out of Ed's legs with the unconscious ease of a lifetime's practice. "It's good to see you, Andy," he said. He was pale and wore his habitual owlish expression of surprise at seeing the world without looking through his older brother's eyes. "It's nice to see you too," Frederick said. He'd always gotten along with Frederick, always liked his ability to play peacemaker and to lend a listening ear. Frederick helped Edward upright, methodically circumnavigating his huge belly, retucking his grimy white shirt. Then he hitched up his sweatshirt over the hairy pale expanse of his own belly and tipped to one side. Alan had been expecting to see Gregory, the core, but instead there was nothing inside Frederick. The Gregory-shaped void was empty. Frederick righted himself and hitched up his belt. "We think he's dead," Edward said, his rubbery features distorted into a Greek tragedy mask. "We think that Doug killed him." He pinwheeled his round arms, then clapped his hands to his face, sobbing. Frederick put a hand to his arm. He, too, was crying. All right, that's it. Talk to you next week.